Good morning and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I am your host, Michelle Cernak. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on animal law. Before we start the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. In today's day and age, animals play an increasingly significant role in the lives of many families, with nearly 80% of households owning at least one pet, according to Statista. Whether as companions, livestock, or for scientific purposes, the legal status and rights of animals have become a growing topic of discussion among scholars and legal professionals. Historically, animals have been classified as personal property, a framework that fails to reflect the deep social and emotional bonds that they provide to a vast number of people. Recently, some Canadian courts have issued innovative decisions that move away from this traditional property-based approach, recognizing the complex relationships between animals and their human companions. While these rulings represent a shift toward better legal protections, they remain groundbreaking and not yet widely adopted. This raises important questions about how animals are currently protected and treated under Ontario law, and what legal challenges and changes may be on the horizon. Joining us now in the studio to discuss the rapidly emerging field of animal law is Lori Graham. Lori is an associate at Lundy Levesque Baum, where she maintains a busy commercial litigation practice and professional liability practice. In addition to her firm's work, Lori provides litigation services to individuals that are facing legal challenges involving their pets. A dedicated advocate, Lori has represented clients before all levels of Ontario courts and various administrative tribunals as well. Her passion for animal law stems from a lifelong involvement in the equestrian industry. Lori grew up on a family farm that bred and raised horses, and she has also been a competitive rider and a strong advocate for animal welfare throughout her life. During her legal studies at the University of Toronto, Lori was heavily involved in pro bono work, a commitment that she proudly continues today. Lori, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lori, I'm going to begin with my first question, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. As previously mentioned, animal law is a rapidly emerging field with broad-ranging effects. In your opinion, Lori, when did you first start noticing an increase in litigation involving animals, and in what areas of law are animals most commonly impacted in Canada?
Yeah, so I think we've had sort of a steady state for a very long time in terms of animals propping up in sort of your property disputes, and you have your sort of dedicated subset of animal statutes that are specifically dealing with animal welfare and things like that. But the biggest uptick in numbers, I would say, has been probably in the last sort of 8 to 10-ish years. That's when you've started to see sort of the pet custody legislation start to take hold, first in the US. And now you're starting to see it in at least one province in Canada. And so, as we've moved more towards seeing animals as pets and members of our family in that sort of last decade, I think you've really started to see a lot more litigation involving animals and also a lot more complicated, complex, and maybe interesting litigation involving animals. In terms of what areas of law you see them cropping up all over. So lots of contract disputes of all different sorts. So buying and selling and all of the things that can go wrong in that process. Payment disputes of all kinds. Ownership disputes. And then in terms of tort law, you're going to see all kinds of different professional negligence and occupiers' liability claims where people are getting hurt, animals are getting hurt on private property, people are having issues with their care providers, their veterinarians, things like that. So you'll see all kinds of claims there. And then again, you'll see in the family law context, you'll start seeing custody disputes and things like that. And that's in addition to, yeah, things like, animal welfare statute and the like. So kind of all over, and maybe more places than you would expect.
Well, thank you, Lori. I guess that kind of leads me to my next question. Pets are now considered more as part of the family for many people. And these disputes that you're mentioning seem to be increasingly showing up in family law cases as well. How do courts typically handle these disputes, and what are the common legal remedies?
Yeah, so for a long time, and really in Ontario, still to this day, pets are treated as property. So it's no different than a car, a radio, a laptop, PS5. And so there's something to be divided if there's a dispute, and if they can't be divided, then they are to be sold, and the money is to be divided. So that's the sort of traditional treatment of them. They don't really get imbued with any kind of emotions. They don't have, in either way, pets towards us or us towards pets. So very different than what you would think of as, when you think of children and that sort of thing. But now, yeah, you're starting to see a shift starting in BC last year, really, where the pets are being treated. Not, they're still treated as property, but they are treated sort of as a different kind of property, where the courts are starting to look, take a more thoughtful and nuanced approach to what role pets play in our family and how important the bonds that we develop with them are, and trying to be a little more thoughtful about how things like custody and care are determined and the like, instead of just looking at sort of the dollars and cents that you would in a traditional property dispute.
And I know, Laurie, you've mentioned BC taking some more progressive steps in this area of law. That kind of leads me into my next question about the approach that the courts have taken, which we refer to as the relational approach. Can you explain what this means and how it works in practice?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's not how it works in my practice in Ontario, but it early last year, so early 2024 in BC, you have a reform to their Family Law Act there, and it changes the way, like I said, that the courts handle disputes with certain animals. So not all animals, but certainly those that fall into the category of pets. So it doesn't include things like agricultural animals and the like, but certainly for your sort of household pets. And so what that does is it basically acknowledges, yes, pets are property, so they're not children, but they are special and we have special bonds with them. And so, when you're trying to make an order in the family law context to deal with a family pet, they've come up with a new set of factors that they want to consider when they're making those determinations. And they are, like I said, more alive to the bonds that animals and their owners have. So you're looking at, what's the relationship between the companion animal and the is there any risk of violence towards the pet from anybody? What's sort of their history with the pet? Is there any threat of cruelty? Who's caring for the animal in practice? And that doesn't just mean who's paying the bills, who's paying the vet bills, so to speak, but who's actually in the home caring for them? And who's going to really be able to meet the needs of that animal on an ongoing basis? Compare that to sort of the traditional approach, something like we would see in Ontario. It's not in, it's not necessarily as different as you might think, but it's the focus is different. It's much more on, okay, well, who bought the animal? Who paid for them? Who's paying for the bills? Whose name is on the paperwork? That sort of thing. And so much less on the kind of bond that's formed and the attitude towards the animal. So yeah, in BC, they've adopted this new approach towards pets and pets in custody cases that lets them take sort of less tangible, less financial factors into consideration when they're dealing with these disputes over pets.
Well, and Lori, do you see these positive steps influencing the courts in Ontario?
Yeah, so I mean, on the one hand, we haven't really seen the courts in Ontario embrace the approach that we've seen in BC, but I will say it's very new, especially in court time. Less than 2 years is definitely in infancy as far as the courts are concerned. And, you know, generally, the way it goes is no one wants to go first. So the fact that BC has taken that first step and now other provinces will have some case law that they can look to and they can kind of look at the statutes in BC and see how they've been implemented and what's working and what's not, that I think will go a long way in giving the other provinces comfort if they then want to move in the in a similar direction. And as lawyers, again, you have case law that you can rely on. Case law out of province isn't going to be, you know, binding, but it is persuasive. So you can certainly rely on it and make your pitch. And then all it takes is, you know, you get one judge on side and then you get a decision in province and then you've got something to build on. So I think we'll get there, but we haven't really seen it formally embraced yet.
And I mean, you did refer to the fact that this is very novel, and we know that courts tend to be quite conservative with novel ideas. Leading into perhaps the downsides of courts implementing something like what BC is doing and treating pets more like children. Do you see any problems with that progression?
Yeah, so I mean, on the one hand, it means there is a lot more for the court to consider, or that a court can consider in terms of the evidence and the record and the relationships that are at stake. But in practical effect, that also means you're asking the court and lawyers to do a lot more work, which can involve a lot more money and a lot more time. And these are, you know, if you're litigating, you know, care and control of an animal, presumably there are emotions that are running very high. So although the court in one on the one hand is saying we want to look at other things besides who's paying the bills for these animals, you know, the more protracted litigation becomes, the more you just have a structural advantage in favor of the person who can last the longest and spend the most. So, you know, it's you're able to spend lots of time and money litigating these concerns now, but that doesn't necessarily always redound to the benefit of who we might like. So there's that. You also get into, you know, you're asking judges in the court to, you know, take on a role that they aren't as accustomed to having. Courts are very good at dollars and cents. They're very good at property disputes. They're very good at contract disputes. They're not inherently that great at things like evaluating relationships and the like. So there's a lot of judicial discretion there. And so there's a lot more room for varied decisions, which, depending on which way it goes, can be good or bad depending on your perspective. But so yeah, there's risk there, and there's certainly a lot more resources that can be utilized and used and abused depending on the case.
Well, thank you, Lori. So I guess moving from that more general thought process, I'd like to ask you more about your particular expertise in equine litigation. What are some of the most common legal disputes involving horses, and how do these cases differ from the disputes over household pets, like we were just discussing?
Yeah, so household pets, typically the parties are going to be The owners, so whoever is in the household, couples that are splitting up and the like, some sort of shared ownership or shared custody that breaks down, and then you're trying to mediate that. Horses, oftentimes horses are boarded at public boarding stables, so then you're going to have a lot more disputes involving sort of the owner of the boarding stable or other boarders at the stable amongst themselves. You're going to have more interactions with things like trainers, vets, haulers, farriers, all those kinds of things. So you have lots more points of friction with outside parties who don't have an ownership stake in the animal. I can say, I think confidently, I was a long-time equestrian. You also have a lot more expenses that are involved in typical day-to-day equine ownership. So a lot more payment disputes and the like. So you and also often have contracts of some degree of sophistication that are ostensibly guiding those relationships that need to be interpreted and the like. So you see a lot more kind of third party disputes that are not just about ownership or custody, but are dealing with these sort of outside entities that also have a stake in keeping horses in kind of today's society.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the equine industry encompasses such important third party arrangements that a lot of people don't necessarily think that they require legal advice when forming a lot of these contracts. And the more involved you get in the equine industry, you really realize there's a lot of liability involved that I think people aren't really familiar with.
There's a ton of liability. First of all, I would say, as a general observation, the equine world has, I suspect you can relate, the level of contract drafting that you encounter regularly in the equine world is not great. It's usually some form of either my insurance company gave it to me and I never looked at it, or I Googled X contract and this was the first one that came up. And me,
The
maybe it was from Canada, usually not. And that's what we used, or we copied and pasted seven different versions, and we forgot to get anybody to sign it. That's pretty standard. Which you would never see in a commercial dispute. You have contracts that are negotiated with lawyers on both sides, and this back and forth. Yeah, almost never in the horse world. So you have contracts that the courts want to put a lot of emphasis on because they like contracts, because they tell them how to interpret the relationship, but also they are often a mess. So there's a lot of room for dispute. There's a lot of room for litigation. And the other piece of that that people, I think, don't often appreciate until they're really in it is at the bottom of almost all of those interactions, vets, boarding stables, farriers, all of that is insurance. So a lot of almost everybody has some form of liability insurance that can respond in one way or another. But knowing how to access that insurance and how it impacts the sort of obligations that each party has is a bit of a trick.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I know from experience, a lot of these agreements, like you said, are copy and pasted from Google search engines. And getting more familiar with contract law myself, you really start to realize the contradictions in a lot of these agreements that if push came to shove, I mean, I don't really think that they would be permitted in the court. Or I don't really know how they would actually be able to justify a decision on these, filings.
Yeah, I mean, even if they're even coherent enough to be interpreted in a consistent way, you do see insurance companies are probably the biggest driving force in terms of introducing contracts into the equine world. They have a practice now of sort of like providing waivers, providing contracts for their their insureds and saying, use these, or otherwise we won't give you coverage. The problem with that is if you are just giving it to a party who hasn't read it, doesn't understand it, and they're having somebody else sign it, hopefully, who doesn't read it and can't understand it, and also couldn't change it if they wanted to, it's going to be a tough contract to uphold in court.
Well, on that note, Lori, I want to talk to you more about neglect cases in the equine industry. And I want to talk to you about how they're usually handled, particularly because I know that they encompass a lot of outdated legal tools, like the Innkeepers Act. And I know that these tools sometimes fail to prioritize the welfare of the animals. And so that leads me into asking, what kind of legal changes or approaches do you think could help ensure that more effective and humane resolutions for high-risk animals are brought on?
So for those that don't know, quickly, the Innkeepers Act is essentially a very old statute, if the name didn't tip you off, that allows someone who's running a public boarding stable basically place a lien on a horse if there is a bill that's unpaid, and there are certain notice provisions and the like. And the eventual result of that is that in order to get that bill paid, you can have a public auction for the horse, sell it off, and put whatever proceeds towards the bill, and give the excess to the former owner. So that exists. It's a mechanism in place essentially to provide a payment solution for boarding stables in a pinch. And it really does reflect horses as property, right? If you have property and you can't pay your bill, same way that you can lien a condo or something like that, you sell it and you use the money to pay the bills. A lot of issues with that in terms of putting it in action. You also don't see it used very often because public auction is a terrible way to sell horses of any value. So it's not perfect for sure. I would say generally there's a huge area of opportunity here for people who are interested in contract drafting, are interested in alternative dispute resolution, really taking advantage of the fact that there's not a lot of governing doctrine in this area, but there are a lot of people who would love to have better negotiated agreements that have more quicker and more responsive ways to respond to non-payment issues, to respond to issues where care is substandard, and allow for some form of private dispute resolution that doesn't necessarily require either something like a public auction or, frankly, going to court. Because the reality in Ontario is that it can take several years to get to court for the first time after you are commencing a lawsuit. So there's a lot of time and space there for creative drafting and for people who have the talent for mediation and the like to do a lot of good work, both for their human clients and the horses that are at stake.
Well, and taking into account the concerns that you've brought up about the timeline and how long this process can take, who really becomes responsible for the care of those horses while they're in this dispute?
So, I mean, in practice, you will see, and again, this is kind of more characteristic of the horse industry than necessarily the legal industry, but you'll see barn owners who are carrying huge tabs for these horses that will, that care about them, and then they're not gonna stop providing care. But they will end up, incurring huge tabs at their own expense. And on the other hand, right, they don't want to relinquish control of the animals, say, like, okay, it's your problem, you feed it from now on, because if they do, then their lien right is affected because Liens require sale, and you can't sell something that you've already let go down the road. So it cascades in a way that is really problematic in an industry that's not, I don't think anyone would describe as particularly lucrative. And it puts people in really difficult situations. And yeah, that's when you start seeing the sort of, well, we put them out in the field, we threw them out back, we gave them whatever hay we had left because we we can't afford to house and feed them the way that we might otherwise if the bill was paid. And so it's not a good situation for anybody. But you find, the horse industry in a lot of ways still works the way it worked 100 years ago. And people are very slow to change, and there's a lot of sort of implicit trust in those relationships, and not always for the best of anybody.
Yeah, I think it goes without saying that I'm hopeful that we're gonna come to better conclusions with the emergence of animal law taking more of a role, I would say, in today's society. And though it's been more focused on pets, I'm really hoping it starts infiltrating into the agricultural industry as well.
Yeah, and like I said, there's a ton of work to be had there, really and truly. There are lots of clients who, especially like I said, not as I work more on the litigation side, which is after things have gone wrong, somebody has to get sued, and we have to sort it all out. But there's a ton of work on the preventative side as well, in terms of drafting agreements that avoid these situations. It can be done. It just hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the past, but there's. I find that the clients are very eager. They would love to have somebody to sit down with to help them, sort of get agreements and policies and procedures in place that will protect them and the horses that they care about.
Great. Well, Laura, you just touched upon your practice in litigation. And so that leads me into my question about what advice you might give to aspiring lawyers such as myself who want to specialize in animal law.
Yeah, I would say there's no one path to animal law. As you can kind of tell from talking about it, animal law touches on a lot of different areas of law, and it touches on a lot of areas that you will study in law school, whether, just in the core curriculum, contract, property, estate planning, family law, you're going to see all of those things. So learn those sort of black letter areas of law, and you can go work in private practice or wherever you want, and just you don't have to start with animal law cases. You can start in commercial disputes, or you can work for the government. You just need to learn how the system works and how the law works in practice. And then when you get, a little more comfortable, and a little bit more on your feet, then you can start to reach out to, people who and your connections who have animal-specific questions, and your job is to really help guide them through the legal system, which then you have the expertise to do. It's just because don't feel like just because you did an article in an animal law job, of which there are probably two articling positions in Canada, that it would be considered animal law proper. Doesn't mean that you're out of it or you're at a disadvantage. It's really a matter of being able to translate your black letter law to owners and sort of the language of animal ownership. So that's what you sort of have to practice. But like I said, to start out, there's no magic to it. Just start where you can and learn sort of contract, property, family law, and then translate that into, the specific clientele that you want to serve.
Great. That's such great advice, Lori. Thank you. And I guess I'm going to ask you one final question. And that's with regard to if there are any concerns or interests that we have yet to bring up, in our discussion today
in terms of animal law that you think are important to mention still?
I think just more to this last piece in terms of translating the law and applying it to these animal relationships. The other piece of that is going the other direction. The other skill is being able to translate your love of animals, those bonds that you have, those astronomical costs that you've incurred that make total sense in your mind because you love your animal, being able to translate that to a court, to a judge. And that's a real skill, and it takes time. Don't overlook, I would say, in that area of law, the importance of relying on experts. And so if you're in private practice, you're developing your skill set, being able to use being comfortable with using experts to provide opinions on your cases, on standard of care and the like, is really important. And so as you're out in the world, you're thinking about, as you're forming relationships with vets and barn owners and other trainers and things like that, coaches, can these people serve as experts for me in the future in a way that can help explain to a judge sitting in downtown Toronto who doesn't own a goldfish why it made a total sense that you spent $50,000 in vet bills on a horse that is probably worth, tenth of that on a good day. So there's lots of, again, that's just like the translation goes both ways. If you're translating the law to the animal owners, and also translating animal ownership to the courts and to judges. So that's the, you have to kind of hone your communication skills both ways. But yeah.
Great. Yeah, Lori, I mean, you completely understand the finite implications of horse ownership and bubble wrapping injury-prone critters.
Afraid so.
And unfortunately, like you said, it's a field that I don't think a lot of people can understand the cents and the dollar ratios unless they're really immersed in it. So I'm definitely
Well,
going to
that
keep that in
assumes that it
mind.
makes sense to us, even as owners, which is maybe it doesn't, but
It's like
yeah,
you
here we
said,
are.
the emotions sometimes, they guide us in the way that might not be logical, but makes sense to us in the moment.
Well, Lori, thank you so much again for taking the time out of your day to come and discuss some of these issues with regards to animal law with us at PBSC and at Queen's Law. I think we've taken up enough of your time, but I just want to say that it has been extremely delightful to listen and to hear to your point of view regarding these issues. And once again, I just want to say thank you very much for joining us today on Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. And to all the listeners out there, thank you all for tuning in. I hope that this was an insightful podcast. Today's show was produced by me, Michelle Cernak. I am also your host. If you like this interview, you could find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website.